So this is the third and final day of our three-day retreat here in Tampa on the transformation of suffering. And I'm not sure at this point whether there are some disappointed people here who might have thought that you were coming to a retreat where the focus would be on the techniques, the technology of transforming suffering, and instead have heard a lot about encountering suffering, being present to suffering, looking deeply into suffering, understanding suffering, right, as the prelude to the transformation. As I said earlier in my first talk, we have a distaste, an uncomfortableness, an avoidance of experiencing suffering and looking at suffering, and we always want to get on to the good stuff. But it is exactly that unwillingness to encounter suffering as it is and to look deeply into causation that really prevents us from really energetically involving ourselves in the path of healing and transformation. And that is why our efforts along the path, whether we are in a formal path such as Buddha Dharma, or whether just we're on our own personal path of healing and transformation, we find that it is difficult. We make progress and then we fall back. We think we're getting somewhere, and then we see we're still dealing with the same stuff over and over. And we wonder why. Well, it's because of this. This very fact. Again, whether you see the Buddha as a historical being very personal, as a human being, or whether you see the story of the Buddha as kind of an archetype, either way, we know his encounter with suffering and his willingness to look deeply into it and to assiduously, dedicatedly, diligently going about understanding its causes and then uprooting it is our model. If that's the kind of a model we're looking for. Each of us have to decide what kind of model we're looking for in this life. So before I go more deeply into the teachings for today, there are just two questions. One question is, in dealing with an addiction such as anxiety, how do you decide whether the garden is fallow or just hasn't ever worked properly? When does leaving a garden become spiritual bypass? I'm not sure exactly what the question is here. Things like anxiety, depression, again, I wouldn't necessarily call anxiety an addiction in the sense that it's usually formulated in the mental health field, but it is certainly an emotional affliction. So I guess the question is, I'm not sure what the question is. I'll say more about that later. Because we're not, you don't have to leave anything. That's a metaphor. And then the next question is, how does one go about finding a teacher, mentor in one's area, a teacher to guide me along the path? That's an excellent question. Not necessarily in everything. But certainly for those people who are undertaking transformation through a spiritual path, especially a traditional spiritual path, such as Buddha Dharma, I believe that having a relationship with a teacher is essential. It does not mean that one cannot, go to talks by teachers. One cannot attend retreat with good teachers. One cannot read the teachings of good teachers, past and present. One cannot watch the DVDs, etc., of a teacher. But that is attending lectures. That is not entering into a mentorship, which is a very different thing and is at the heart of the meditative tradition, right? In other words, there needs to be feedback. You know, many people enter the spiritual realm, they want to, what's it called? You know, where you go to class, but you don't, you're just, you're auditing. Yeah, yeah. Many people want to audit. They want to go to all the lectures, they want to this, but they don't want to do really anybody, they don't want to be accountable for doing or responsible for doing the work. Right? That's the way many people do it. And you wonder why, you know, you learn a lot. You know, you can learn a lot from auditing classes. But, you know, tests, papers that are graded, and most importantly, interaction, you know, with the teacher to give you feedback, to give you correction, to give you personal guidance is essential, I think, in any field that one wants to advance in, whether that is a craft, whether that is a profession, mentorship for those, apprenticeship is essential. You know, there has to be that hands-on learning. As Alex said yesterday, you know, how do you get out of your worldview? It seems so real. Self seems so normal. You know, this endless projection that we believe is what the world is about seems so normative to us. It's very hard for us to have accurate, objective perception of our own delusions, especially since we believe and totally identify with them. So we need the mirror, right? We need someone to hold up the mirror to us, because we cannot see ourselves. As well as, we need the encouragement, we need the explanation, we need these generic wondrous teachings of Dharma individualized. So in our own development, they can be applied succinctly and skillfully. The Buddha had his students who he interacted with. And that has been the tradition until up to today. Unfortunately, today, a lot of the transmission that goes on is done, again, through books, through large talks, through retreats with large numbers in which there's very little interaction. And so many people, even though they may look to a certain teacher as their teacher, really have very little relationship, personal relationship or interaction with them. So a teacher is essential. Please look for one. I can only speak for myself. I think even though I've studied and practiced for 40 years, I think the most meaningful encounters of my life were with my teachers, my three main teachers. My first teacher, Roshi Philip Kaplow, I had to move to Rochester, New York. Terrible long winters. a place I would not choose to live. But I lived there for 6-7 years to study with him. Of course, I was younger then and had the freedom. To meet Thich Nhat Hanh in the 70s, I had to go to France. To meet my Tibetan teachers, I had to go to India and Nepal. I mean, you know. It depends what your thirst is. But these days, people are much more fortunate these days. 30, 40 years ago, there was very few teachers here in America. Now there are many more teachers. But I think it's essential that if one is serious about practice, that one find a teacher. I mean, a lot more can be said about teacher-student, but why don't we stop there? dukkha. Suffering. I'm glad you have a smile on your face when you hear those words. It's interesting that in terms of the Four Noble Truths, again, if we look developmentally, if we look sequentially, the Four Noble Truths supposedly were the first teachings that the Buddha gave post his great enlightenment. And even though he taught for 40 to 50 more years, gave many more different teachings, all types of teachings to all kinds of people, these Four Noble Truths, which include in the fourth, the Eightfold Path, was his first quintessential teaching of his Dharma. So in that case, I think it's worth attending to. The interesting thing is, you know, in Buddhism, the operating principle of everything is cause and effect. That everything that is happening, which is an effect of a prior cause, and that prior cause is the effect of a prior cause, and that this is the movement of the universe, and that there's always a relationship between cause and effect. Right? Apple seeds do not produce pears. Pear seeds do not produce apples. So the causal relationship between cause and effect needs to be understood and acknowledged. The interesting thing is, when you look at the Four Noble Truths, is that the Buddha began with the effect, right? He begins with suffering, and then his second noble truth is the what causes it. You would think more logically he would have gone the other way. You know, this is the cause and this is the effect. But I think it's, again, because sentient beings means us, you know, we are so identified with this world, and we are so identified with accepting the normality of suffering. And living in so much denial about the greater themes of what is occurring, that he said, no, let me begin. Let me just understand. These people need to understand what's going on in life. Right? Because they will not stop. Right? We were talking yesterday about, you know, what makes the alcoholic stop, right? It is only when they acknowledge that what they are doing, which used to seem like so much fun, is really suffering. Right? And until they get that and really see that the condition that they have created in their life and they've created for others is miserable, right? It is not happiness. It is not well-being. It is not love. It is not ease. You know, so you have to see that to stop. Right? When you see it and you stop, then, as we said yesterday, there is an opening. There's a crack in the veneer, Alex. Right? There's a crack in that worldview where you acknowledge whatever it is, it's not producing what I want. It's actually, if I look deeply at it, for all my effort, and I won't go into it again, it has produced something opposite to what I had hoped for, wished for, or what I was told would happen, right? So what we dealt with yesterday is really, in a certain way, you could go that way too in cause and effect, right? And again, as I said, and I think it's important that each of us understand that because this omnipresent suffering of all types, from the most gross and obvious to the most subtle, there is a cause, or there are causes, of which, as we talked yesterday, there are some special, significant root causes of the whole thing, right? Which we called yesterday ignorance, delusion, believing in a separate self, believing in permanence, believing in solidity, right? Because this suffering, this unhappiness, this misery, this dissatisfaction, because of all these emotional afflictions that exist in the human realm, and from which human beings act and react and interact, because there are very specifically identifiable causes, that means what? That if the causes are either eliminated or changed into something else, a different effect will occur. Is that clear? This is very important, right? So this whole, what I've been belaboring with you for two days, and perhaps Darlene and Angie have also just, just rubbing your nose in it over and over. Again, when you understand that it is caused, there is a causal relationship between the experience of suffering and what is causing it. If I get that, all I need to do is what? Change the causes. Right? And I will have different effects. Right? Is that clear? So you can see it is an optimistic, creative, transformative, happy path. Why should we be happy? Why should our practice of the way be joyful? Just for that fact, right? Just for that fact. But you have to get it, you know what I mean? It's like, oh, I don't have to live in this miserable swamp for the rest of my life, right? There is a way out. There is another way. I can put on a new roof that doesn't leak and my house will be dry. I would have never thought of that myself. I thought, because everybody around me had a leaky roof, right? I thought this was normal. You see, I just saw it, living in a cold, miserable house with a leaky roof was normal because everybody else was doing it and experiencing it. And then somebody shows up in my village and says, oh no, there's another kind of roof you can put on. And then your house will be dry and warm. Right? Different causes create different effects. Knowing that there is another way, knowing that there is a way to uproot suffering, unhappiness, misery, I won't go on to it. You know the list. That is the basis that in the practice that we undertake, there's great happiness, there's great joy, there's great relief, right? That comes from understanding, every thing has a cause. And once I understand that operating principle, if I start making different causes in my life, I will have different effects. Where? In my mind, essentially. And it will manifest then in my speech and the actions of my body. But because the essential illusions, delusions, ignorances are in the mind, and that the actions stem from the mind, even though they manifest in words, and even though they manifest in physical activity, Buddhism puts great emphasis on the transformation of the mind. That is why in this path, mindfulness, meditation, concentration, insight, cultivation of wisdom is so essential. This is where the mind has to be transformed. Because it's the mind that's causing us the problems. So, suffering, cause of suffering. Cessation of suffering, cause of cessation of suffering. Right? Third and fourth noble truth. Again, it is the Buddha's enlightenment. That is the bell. That is the wake-up bell. It was his enlightenment in his actually going through all aspects of his conditioning and arriving at his unconditioned, unstained, beyond birth and death, Buddha mind. And his realization that this mind, this unstained, pure, mirror-like mind, luminous, all-knowing, right, is the mind of all beings and has never, never in any way been contaminated by all the neuroses and afflictions and projections that we have put on it. It was because of him realizing that all the causation of suffering can be ceased, right? And a state of absolute happiness and peace can be realized, that we have the third noble truth, right? Nirvana, Nirodha, the cessation of suffering. Right? So this is important, that we accept that truth. This is a truth that we have to accept on what? On faith. Because it's not our realization yet. And again, it could be difficult. Because you go, well, you know, he lived 2,500 years ago. How do I know it's not a myth? Right? How do I know it's not a myth? You know, people over time, 2,500 years, people could have just exaggerated a bit. You know. Maybe he just learned, better coping skills. Right? Maybe that was it. And maybe he just healed his wounded child and, learned to accept things as they are. He was sort of a perceptive, sensitive human being, and maybe that's really all it was. But no. How do we know no? Beside his own writings, beside the experience of those who experienced him, because we know that he elucidated a path of living, the Eightfold Path, which is a path of living, a path of action, a path of meditation, a path of insight, because we know that for 2,500 years, generation after generation, generation after generation, man, women, all different races, all different cultures, all different economic classes, we know that countless beings, having followed his prescription of causation for transformation, right, have produced similar effects. Is that clear? This is important. This is important. That in the Eightfold Path, we have a whole other way. This is the field, what people say. This is the field that we are now cultivating. And people, just like us, two eyes, a nose, a mouth, full boat of suffering and neuroses, mental projections, worldviews, whatever you want to call it, by following this path, have demonstrated over and over again. We may not know always, even though there appear to be historically many, many great masters who have achieved great enlightenment, full enlightenment, somewhat equal to the Buddha's. But we know even short of that. And we know in our own time, we encounter beings who are just like us. You know, they have to go to the bathroom. They have full bladders, right? They eat. They bathe. They get stomach aches. People just like us have attested to the transformative power of this path. Is that clear? So this is not just an ancient fable, right? This is true to today. And it is in the meditative traditions especially, because these are actualization traditions, these are realization traditions, these are meditative traditions that put into practice, right? Many people today, Buddhism in many parts of the world, really has become just another religion. People kind of have elevated the Buddha to almost a godlike status. People worship the Buddha, pray to the Buddha, and do their best to follow some of his dharma. But it is only in the meditative traditions. Teacher to student, mind-to-mind transmissions, as it's called in Zen, has been preserved for over 2,600 years. But it points in a different direction than the world. Right? Because what it says is, if you begin with that fundamental ignorance, and again, this ignorance that we have, unfortunately, is more than a not knowing, you know, like not knowing the right way or not knowing the true way. It's unfortunately that is, as Alex said yesterday, it is a worldview that we actively propagate. Right? So this is important to understand that our ignorance is not just a passive thing. Right? I am ignorant of, you know, the way to happiness. It's no, I am actually deeply invested in the way of suffering. Right? And no matter how much I read and how much I study, you know, when the pedal hits the metal, is that the right expression? The pedal hits the metal? When the pedal hits the metal, you know, there I am again. Right? You know, we read, we study, we go to retreats, you know, we have our spiritual personas, but when we meet up with situations that push us, that scratch us, there he and she is again. The beast is out. Right. Hurt, sadness, anger, resentment, fear. Well, you know, it's all right there, right? So we have to understand that we have to actively do practices that take us in a direction away from the world of self. Right? Now, for example, the practice of mindfulness. Right? Very simple practice. Right? Very simple, very basic practice. But when I am just drinking my tea, when I am looking, smelling, tasting, present to life just as it is, I am not involved in the drama of self, am I? I am out of self momentarily, and into life as it is. So learning to be more present to life as it is, right? So when I talk to John, if I talk to John and my head is full of projections and interpretations and judgments or thinking about other things, I'm not practicing mindfulness, am I? Even though I'm talking to John, I'm what? I'm still totally in the narrative of Fred, right? If I'm looking around and going, oh, look at that beautiful tree, look at that, oh, somebody's got a trim over there, and I'm thinking about what happened yesterday, and Franciscan Center, you know what I mean? I'm what? I'm not out of myself, am I? It's myself. Worldview is just taking whatever is going on and making up a story about it. Is that clear? So the practice of mindfulness done correctly is a great antidote, a beginning point to begin to get out of the narrative, right? When somebody else is talking, what do? I listen. Right? I just listen. And I do my best to what? To understand them. Right? Most of us don't even listen to the other person, right? We already have a rebuttal, right? There's already a rebuttal. There's already interpretation. You know, I got to get my side in. That's not listening. So in all our encounters, we're just reifying our belief in a separate self. And that my thoughts, my feelings, my projections, my understandings are the truth. They are not the truth. You know, much of the suffering of the world is because what? Because not only does Alex have a worldview, right, that's very, like he says, very comprehensive, very complete, and seems perfectly logical and understandable and absolutely true, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Absolutely. I knew you would agree. But Alex's problem is that everybody else he encounters has the same thing. See, that's the problem, isn't it?
If they would all just say, yeah.
Right.
I'd be happy.
Unfortunately, for all your efforts, and I know you have made valiant efforts over the years, it is one of those things that you have to become disillusioned that it will never occur. That's the problem. So all of us have to realize, you know, I cannot get everybody else out first, but first I can get myself out. Mindfulness is a good beginning. What we did this morning is a good beginning, as it is said. You know, we need to stop making causes for suffering. If you listen to the 5 mindfulness trainings, we can see, right, that what is being stated is, through the observation and the practice of these 5 mindfulness trainings, in major areas of our life, we stop, we end creating suffering for ourselves. Or another way to say it is, we stop making negative causes. Right? In the realm of our behavior, our actions, our speech. And if we are instead no longer making negative causes, but we are making instead positive causes. Right? Not only am I keeping my mouth shut and no longer saying negative things, harmful things, things that cause conflict, et cetera, et cetera. Stopping that. Okay. I'm no longer creating that negative karma with this. Look at this. Such a little thing. And yet it has such power to what? To create harm and suffering and conflict and misunderstanding. Now, so the one thing I can do is put some duct tape over it, and at least I am no longer creating that. But how much better if I could learn to use my speech, to be supportive, to be kind, to be helpful, to be compassionate, to create understanding and harmony, right? So, not only not in all the realms of activity, you know, we can not only stop, right, making causes that will create, it will just continue. You know, if you want to understand why you have all the kind of thoughts you do, all the impulses that you do, all the ways of acting and speaking and all your emotions, if you want to know why, it's all because of past. The causes are all there. You've done it before. And we just keep replaying it, right? New day, new opportunity to perpetuate my delusion on the world. Right? How much misery can I cause today for myself and others, right? We laugh. And yet, what's the truth, Steve? We do it, don't we? Even though we don't want to, right? Even though we don't want to, and we aspire not to, and we read all this good stuff not to, yet we cannot help ourselves often. Why is that? Because we have the seeds of the past in us, and they will not go away. They can only be what? Healed, transformed, as well as we need to develop a whole new repertoire of thought, perception, speech, action, of body. Now, the fallow field. So, as was said yesterday, this world, and in Buddhism we call this the world, we call this the world of phenomena, right? Phenomena means everything. It's phenomena. Right? So, everything we see, everything we smell, everything we taste, all the sounds that we hear, all the feelings, sensations in our body, and all the thoughts and perceptions, beliefs, memories, images that appear in our minds, right? Right? Everything. Right? All those things are just phenomena, right? They're just happen. It's what, you know, from the moment you get up to when I, you know, you're thinking, smelling, tasting, looking, feeling, right? Okay. When we're in the world of delusion, that is all occurring within the purview, the arena, the worldview of the self. Right? And how does the self deal with phenomena of these types? It does what? It makes a story. And the story is either a good story. If it's a good story, we go what? I want more of that. If it's a bad story, it's like, I want to get that out of here. Or else we're indifferent. It's kind of a neutral thing. And all day long, that's what self is up to. From that, everything else comes. Now, the ups and downs, the backs and forths, endless world of change, which is, as we said yesterday, is just the way it is. But ego can't accept that. It wants things to be its way, right? So, we need to, at the depth, change our relationship to phenomena. Stop grasping. Stop attaching. Stop avoiding. And begin to see things just as they are. How are they? How are things? How are trees? Trees are just what? Trees are just trees. They do what they do. Right? Tea is just tea. Right? People are just people. The world is just the world. Why is it the way it is? Because of causes and conditions. Right? I mean, why are they those big oak trees out there and not big stands of bamboo? Because cause. Causes and conditions, right? Why is there a river out there and not a mountain? Because of causes and conditions. Why are there wars? Why is there violence? Because of causes and conditions. Right. Why is today what it is? You know, why was it warm in here when I came in? Why is it cooler now? Causes and conditions. Right. Things just change. We need to learn to accept things as they are and stop this endless interference with things as they are. Interference is grasping, attaching, avoiding, manipulating, controlling, right? All of which produces what? Dukkha. But if you don't do that, you have nirvana. You're at peace. The world's at peace. Throughout the day, we have choices. In this moment, do I want nirvana or do I want dukkha? It's important. It's not a joke. It's true. We have great capacity. Human beings are we are so screwed up that we it's like sickness, old age, death. You know, all the stuff that's going on, and you think that'd be enough for us to deal with? But no, we have to what? We have our own self-created suffering, right? You know, I mean, you know, you can put me in a room by myself, and I can have all kinds of I can have an anxiety attack. I can get depressed. I mean, I can feel lonely. I can get angry. I can get resentful. I mean, right? I can dredge up all kinds of stuff, memories, right? You know, just leave me alone for 10 minutes. I'm happy. I can create lots of good suffering for myself, even though nothing's going on, right? It's a nice day. How many people over the last 3 days created suffering for themselves, experienced dukkha? And yet, look. I mean, this is a piece of cake. Right, people are cooking for us. Roxanne, I know Roxanne. Delicious food. You know, we have a nice bed. It's been good weather, right? You know, decent people. Nobody's talking too loud, so no one. I mean, if there's any 3 days where we should have all been in nirvana, right? There's 3 days. Has everybody been in nirvana? No, because we have often this capacity, right? Because of what? Because of ignorance. And from that fundamental ignorance and that identification with self, and self as it interacts with phenomena, grasping, avoiding, creating stories, emotional afflictions, past, memories, we have the capacity to what? As Alex, I keep quoting you, Alex, as Alex said, we have the capacity of, quote, unfortunately, I'm using you as the guru of dukkha. But as our guru Alex told us, we have this great capacity for developing a worldview that is so complete, so tight, seems so right, right? And we just take it wherever we go. Doesn't matter where we go, where we do, who we're relating to. It's a fallow field. Now, even in a fallow field, right? See, if all I have is a fallow field, right? That's all I have. And I understand that it is a fallow field. And I understand that whether I work 10 hours a week or whether I work 60 hours a week, I'm only going to produce kind of small tomatoes, small potatoes. Right? I mean that's it. When I understand that and can accept that, I'm no longer resentful. I'm no longer disappointed. I'm no longer, you know, any of that. Or I'm no longer working so hard to, you know, I'll try something new this week. You know what I'm saying? You can actually experience nirvana in a fallow field if you no longer are projecting your expectations, your hopes, your want. That's all the drama of self. The fallow field is the fallow field. It can produce what it can produce. We can work with it and maybe make it better, but we have to begin with the reality, this is what it is. And then what? We can be at peace. And when we're at peace, we have the opportunity of being happy, of being peaceful. Right? And you know what? If instead of working 60 hours a week, you only realize, I only need to put in 20 hours a week. Right? Get the same result. Well, maybe there's something much more meaningful I could do with those extra 20, 30, 40 hours that I've been putting into the fallow field. I don't know. Maybe I can go help another human being in their field. Maybe I could look more deeply into life. Time. We spend a lot of time, energy, in activities and pursuits that are not conducive, will not produce happiness, meaning, joy. That's the truth, isn't it? So yesterday, what time are we supposed to stop? 11:30? So we have 15 minutes. Okay. Because I'll stop at 11:15 so people can set up. The great Mahayanist, the great Buddhist teacher, Shantideva, in his text, The Way of the Bodhisattva, as I quoted yesterday, he said it quite simply. All the happiness of the world comes from cherishing others. All the misery of the world comes from cherishing oneself. Buddhas know that. Childish sentient beings don't. And that is another way of saying what we've been saying today. When we leave off a life of egocentricity, egocentricity means what? See, some people think egocentricity means, arrogance. Or he's a real egoist. No, we're all egocentric. Egocentric in Buddhism means that myself is the center of my experience. Right? I am egocentric. Self-centered. Even if I'm a nice person, even if I'm outwardly a compassionate person, that just means the edges of self have been softened. The edges of self are not as hard as other people, right? There are many people where self is rigid, highly defined, omnipresent. And we call that person what? A narcissist, we could say. That's pathological. So many of us, within the context of self, have softened, have opened. It's more porous. But still, when push comes to shove, me, I, is the point that these eyes look out at the world. The more deeply we let go of that through the practices of mindfulness, through the practices of concentration, through the practices ultimately of insight, so we really understand what's really going on and the true nature of things, we have the capability of no longer making our spiritual life coping better, softening, opening, but really taking a totally different stance. One way that we can easily understand what that other stance is what Shanti Davis says. Right. Cherish others. Stop cherishing self. Right. Now, what does that mean? That means as we go through our day, instead of always projecting my needs, my wants, my views on everybody and everything I encounter, right? I am open and present that everybody I encounter, which is more than me, I'm just one, right? So if I'm one and I go through a day and I encounter 20 people, let's say, okay? Then my capacity to see, be, view life through those other people means in each of those encounters I have the opportunity of getting out of self and seeing life or even an encounter, an exchange from somebody else's views. When you do that, you are changing your stance. Right. You are changing your stance. The more that we have the capacity. Now again, this is not codependency, because codependency and things like that are all pathological. They're based on unhealthy, you know, codependency is people, you know, I'm nice to people because secretly I have an agenda. Which is what? I want people to like me. I want people to love me. I want people to think I'm a good person. You know, so it's manipulative. It's self-manipulating. This is not that. Right? This is open-heartedness. This is compassion. Right? This is healthy. It's really understanding that egocentricity is pathological. Because it produces disease. Right? Again, all our efforts, all the efforts of self to maintain itself and to meet its needs in this world of change, the eight worldly winds like we talked about, ultimately do not produce happiness, peace, meaning. When we understand that, then we have the opportunity of living a life for others. That is not, again, it is not driven by unhealthy tendencies. It's not driven by any other need other than an acknowledgement that we are all in this together. Or even better, when there's no barrier, there's no postulation, self, other, me, you, inner, outer, that we're all the same. We're all in this together, all beings, one body. Right? We're all interconnected. And the truth is, when you live a life like that, you will be happy. Because all your unhappiness comes from your self-concern. All your unhappiness comes from your self-concern. And even though you may experience happiness in this life when things are going well for yourself, I assure you, you will at some point experience the opposite when things are not going well for yourself. That's the deal. That's the Faustian deal. You want to get out of that. You want your happiness not to be based on conditioned things. When you let go, let go, let go. See things as they really are, accept them as they really are, and deal with phenomena openly, wisely, skillfully, compassionately. You, each of us, will be happy, will be joyful. we'll feel free. Now, does anybody disagree with me? Because, you know, we're going to end in a few minutes, and you're going to go home, and you're going to resume your life. You know your life? And you're going to, you know, you're going to go back to work, or you're going to go back to your families, your friends. You know, you're going to go back to life as it always has been. And, you know, most people go to retreat like vacations. You know, when you go on vacation, especially if you get a good long 2-week vacation, right? How do you feel at the end of those 2 weeks? If you had a good vacation, you feel good. You feel great. And then your first day back at work, Monday, is how? Pretty good. The effects of vacation. Yeah, I'm overwhelmed. I hope not. I hope you get a couple of good days. Right, but oftentimes the effects of the vacation last a few days. Right? Monday's a good day. But as the week goes on, you get back into it. Everything starts getting big again, important again. And by Friday, what? John needs a vacation. So in that sense, unfortunately, that's why retreat as just good experience, vacation, while it's good, it's not very good. Because we want to go back into life and transform our daily life. So it is different. So if we leave here today and go back home to our relationships, go back home to our work, go back home to all our activities, and continue to do it the way we've always done it, we will continue to experience the same. There is no doubt of that, because this world operates on cause and effect. And unless we are making new causes, unless we are responding differently to the manifestation of old effects and old causes, everything will continue the same. And I am not a prophet. I do not have that kind of insight. This is just the way it is. Right? So, this must be practiced. Now again, practicing it by ourselves is often difficult, because as our guru of suffering and dukkha and delusion has told us, our worldview seems so right and true. And we've always lived in it, right? And it's so we need these constant practices that remind us. We need to be remembering dukkha and all the types of dukkha and the causes of dukkha. So when they arise in our life, we can name it. We can see clearly. We need the teachings. We need the teachers. We need the sangha to support us in our transformation. Very difficult to do it on our own. In the incense chant, we say what? May we be companions of Buddhas. You know that verse? You sang that today. May we be companions of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. What does that mean? That's very important. Right? Who are our companions on this path? It's important to ask yourself. You know, if I'm about to climb Mount Everest, I want companions who are in good shape. I want companions who know about mountain climbing. Right? I want companions who who are as dedicated to getting to the top as I am. Right? And I'd love to have a companion or two who's done it before. Right? Wow. You know, who are your companions on this path? And you've got to look around, because if your companions are people who aren't interested, don't get it, or actually are, you know, living a totally different way, they may be companions of yours, right? But they're not companions on the path. Is that clear? Mm-hmm. So I'm not saying, you know, chuck them all. But understand, we need to be companions of Buddhists and Bodhisattvas at the same time, right? Again, even if you're a mountain climber, you can have lots of non-mountain climbing friends and family, can't you? But for mountain climbing, you want your fellow mountain climbers, right? Let me get that clear? Yeah, I mean, it's kind of simple. And again, if we are serious about, you know, the path of transformation and healing and awakening, you know, we need to have Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. We have to see them as our companions. We need spiritual friends to be our companions. On this path, again, it doesn't mean that. Again, I just want. Doesn't mean, you know, everybody goes home, packs their bags. I'm not saying that. We can have many nice companions in this life who aren't on the path. But for walking the path, we need, and we want to feel the Buddha, the Bodhisattvas, all the teachers and masters. When you hear their teachings, when you read their teachings, when you attend their teachings, see them as your friend. See them as your wise uncle. Feel relationship. Feel how wonderful. I'm so happy to have a relationship with you. Thank you. You know, even when you pick up a book of some master who lived 1,000 years ago, and when they, in the book, they share their teaching, their life, you know, make them your friend. Make them your companion. Use them, you know, take them along the path with you. Is that clear? We need companions. We need, as we said today, in the transmission ceremony, Buddha Dharma Sangha. We need them all in our life if we want to walk this path. So it's 11:15. Is anything unclear? Anybody have any questions? Yes.
I think this is a question that I might have asked you 5 years ago, and I'm still not clear on it.
Good.
I completely find joy when I help others.
Mm-hmm.
I do that.
Mm-hmm.
But I had to do a lot of work on me first,
mm-hmm.
to take care of me first,
mm-hmm.
because I had a lot of suffering.
Mm-hmm.
And I, especially women, people grow up with doing for, are told to do for others,
mm-hmm.
especially women,
mm-hmm.
told still to be in the home and take care of your kids and your mm-hmm. husband.
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't give them happiness, because
mm-hmm.
they're not taking care of themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't hear that in what you're saying. And somewhere in there, people have to learn to take care of themselves. I think we once had a discussion where I had asked you about, I had learned to love myself.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you didn't agree with that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't agree with that.
Right. Right. So I, may, even though you've told me before, will you tell me again?
Yeah, I mean, there's no, I don't.
Can you repeat the question?
Yeah, the question is, you know, just very succinctly, you know, a lot of people, their helping of others is something they've been instilled with, trained with, made to feel. It's a responsibility, but it's often, you know, that kind of service to others, more specifically women, their families, or whatever. But I would say men, too. We could say the same thing. You know, they're trained to go off to work, and often that's not the happiest environment either for them, and they're unfulfilled. So you say, well, this is a lot of personal suffering going on. Can you really be there for others as long as you're suffering at a great deal? And don't you have to love yourself before you love others? And working backwards, loving myself just sounds like another kind of narcissism. You know, I am in love with myself. It's you know, that kind of love, whether it's you know, in the Buddha's teachings on love, romantic love is not included. Not because it's not very much part of the human experience, but because it is ego-based and because it is emotional-based, and because, as many people here can attest to, who's ever been in love or out of love, it is not always a source of happiness and often becomes a source of suffering. I mean, just the state of being in love is a source of suffering. I mean, people are just wacko when they're in love. Right. You know. And, you know, they're blind. Anyhow. So, I would say, to me, love, real love, is understanding. When you love another human being, you understand them deeply. You accept them for who they are. And your relationship to them is based on understanding, acceptance, compassion, loving kindness. Right? That's about relationship. Again, because of the way one was raised or whatever, one has significant wounds that prevent one from, in any authentic or meaningful way, relating to people in the way I describe, obviously what you said is step one. Right? That's step one. In the same way, just if I was going to do anything, if I didn't have the physical ability to do it, first I'd have to get the physical ability before I could then do it, right? So, yes, in that sense. But there are all degrees of that, you see. You know, if someone is so wounded, so hurt, that they do not have that capacity, you know, or else all that capacity always just creates more suffering, I would totally agree with you. Stop, heal thyself, and then, you know, over time begin to enter the world of others. But again, I think, having said that, not everybody's in that extreme place. Many of us are in the place we're in because of our obsessive involvement with self. And oftentimes, getting out of self. And being open to the suffering of another is very transformative and helpful to ourself, as you know. So I think I think for most people, it is a path where both tracks can be running at the same time. And actually, there's great interaction. But again, in terms of what you're saying, for people who are significantly wounded in this life, or really just because of life situations, do not have skills or abilities in that area and seem to always get it wrong, yeah, I think it'd be good to spend some time just working on themselves and you know, apprenticeship under a sponsor, a mentor, somebody who can show them how to skillfully and openly enter life. I remember once reading a recovered alcoholic who said, you know, in our tradition, he said, you know, in any time, he says, anytime I get into, I don't know if this is part of the tradition or his thing, he said, anytime I get into any kind of self-pitying, any kind of me, or poor me, he said, I've been told, you know, there's somebody worse off than you, go help a drunk. I don't know if that's, and he said, you know, that's right. He said, you know, I get out of myself that way. Because one, I get out of myself because now I'm onto somebody else, but I'm also acknowledging that my suffering is not unique. You see, we think our suffering is unique, right? You know, nobody suffers like I do, right? And that's not true. We all suffer in different degrees. And, you know, this sense of uniqueness, again, is part of our egocentricity. You know, you look around, you know, why do I just care about myself, right? See, that's part of the problem. You know, I mean, my suffering is so omnipresent in me because I'm always focused on it. Well, what if I wasn't always focused on it? Now, again, this is not denial. This is not repression. But this is going, could it possibly be that by always obsessing about it and being involved in it, it just keeps it going? Right? You know? I mean, my sense is, if somebody who means you harm, or somebody's just an obnoxious personality, somebody a really negative personality, right? Somebody you just don't want to be involved with, because when you're always involved with them, they always just bring you down. You know, get caller ID. Right? That's what I do. Right? Telemarketers can't get to me, can they? Because you can see who it is. And then you can skillfully decide, do I want to pick it up or not pick it up? Right? There's all kinds of stuff, things that arise in our mind, thoughts, feelings, perceptions, that if we pick them up, if we get involved in them, are only going to cause us suffering. Right? If you don't pick them up often, in and of themselves, they weaken. They weaken, just by themselves. Some things, we talked earlier, there's some kinds of sufferings that have to be dealt with. They're just very deep and strong. But all kinds of things, stop responding to them. Because when we respond to them, we reify them, they go back into our laya vijnana, our subconscious, in the same strong way, and they'll come back up again. Because we keep replaying it over and over in our mind. Same mental patterns, same dramas, same memories, right? You know what I'm talking about? Over and over, endlessly. And we wonder why they keep coming up. Because we keep playing them. Stop playing them. How do you stop playing them? You practice mindfulness of thoughts and feelings. You're aware of what's arising in your mind. You see it and you can identify it. Positive, negative. Yeah, this way of thinking is good, right? Thoughts of compassion, thoughts of loving kindness, thoughts of patience. This good stuff. It creates goodness in me. I want that to strengthen. And all those other types of petty, constrictive, narrow, narcissistic way of thinking are just, people ruminate endlessly about painful things, don't they? That's sick. That creates pathology. Why do it? I mean, can anybody give me a good reason to ruminate on things that cause you suffering? I mean, it was bad enough the first time. Right? I mean, it's... Cessation of suffering is possible. Cessation of suffering is doable. Luckily, we live in a time where Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha are available. There are many places where Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha is not available in this world. Or many people's lives are just either because of tremendous amount of sufferings or because of their own obsessions and whatever, are just not open any kind of path of transformation, of healing, of love, all the things we talk about. So we are very fortunate, right, that we that these teachings and practices are still alive, accessible, and that we have the time like this to come together for 3 days and practice. Please don't waste this opportunity you have in this life. You never know, right? We don't know what's going to happen. Know what's happening in life. We don't know what happens with our body. For all you know, this is the last place alive today. Everything else is gone. I didn't want to tell you that earlier. I didn't want to ruin your retreat. But you don't know for sure that hasn't happened, do you? Mm-hmm. We don't know. We think we know, but we don't know. We don't know anything. That's not true. There's one thing we do know. In this moment, right now, I am alive. And I have the ability in this moment, if I am conscious, to manifest the way I want to manifest. Right? Each of us have that capability. So please remember that, understand that, practice that. And so we will end now.